the punk, was Philip Reardon, who weeks ago had reported to Claude Slagenhop. "No, he won't let me in. He won't give me a job. I've tried as he wanted me to. I've tried my best, but it's no use. He won't let me set foot inside his mills. And as to his frame of mind, listen, it's bad. It's worse than anything I expected. I know him, and I can tell you that you won't have a chance. He's pretty much at the end of his rope. One more squeeze will snap it. You said the big boys wanted to know. Tell them not to do it. Tell them he... Claude, God help us. If they do it, they'll lose him."
"Well, you're not of much help," Slagenhop had said dryly, turning away.
Philip had seized his sleeve and asked, his voice shrinking suddenly into open anxiety, "Say, Claude, according to Directive 10-289, if he goes, there's to be no heirs."
"That's right.
They'd seize the mills and everything."
"That's the law."
"But, Claude, they wouldn't do that to me, would they?"
"They don't want him to go, you know that. Hold him if you can."
"But I can't. You know I can't because of my political ideas and everything I've done for you. You know what he thinks of me. I have no hold on him at all."
"Well, that's your tough luck."
"Claude," Philip had cried in panic, "Claude, they won't leave me out in the cold, will they? I belong, don't I? They've always said I belonged. They've always said they needed me. They said they needed men like me, not like him. Men with my sort of spirit, remember? And after all I've done for them, after all my faith and service and loyalty to the cause..."
"You damn fool," Slagenhop had snapped. "Of what use are you to us without him?"
On the morning of November 4th, Hank Reardon was awakened by the ringing of the telephone. He opened his eyes to the sight of a clear, pale sky, the sky of early dawn in the window of his bedroom, a sky the delicate color of aquamarine, with the first rays of an invisible sun giving a shade of porcelain pink to Philadelphia's ancient rooftops. For a moment, while his consciousness had a purity to equal the skies, while he was aware of nothing but himself and had not yet reharnessed his soul to the burden of alien memories, he lay still, held by the sight and by the enchantment of a world to match it, a world where the style of existence would be a continuous mourning. The telephone threw him back into exile. He was screaming at spaced intervals like a nagging chronic cry for help, the kind of cry that did not belong in his world. He lifted the receiver, frowning.
"Hello?"
"Good morning, Henry," said a quavering voice. It was his mother.
"Mother, at this hour?"
he asked dryly.
"Oh, you're always up at dawn, and I wanted to catch you before you went to the office."
"Yes, what is it?"
"I've got to see you, Henry. I've got to speak to you today. Sometime today. It's important."
"Has anything happened?"
"No." "Yes. That is, I've got to have a talk with you in person. Will you come?"
"I'm sorry, I can't. I have an appointment in New York tonight. If you want me to come tomorrow..."
"No, no, not tomorrow. It's got to be today. It's got to."
There was a dim tone of panic in her voice, but it was the stale panic of chronic helplessness, not the sound of an emergency, except for an odd echo of fear in her mechanical insistence.
"What is it, Mother?"
"I can't talk about it over the telephone. I've got to see you."
"Then if you wish to come to the office..."
"No, not at the office. I've got to see you alone where we can talk. Can't you come here today as a favor? It's your mother who's asking you a favor. You've never come to see us at all, and maybe you're not the one to blame for it either. But can't you do it for me this once, if I beg you to?"
"All right, Mother. I'll be there at 4 o'clock this afternoon."
"That will be fine, Henry. Thank you, Henry. That will be fine."
It seemed to him that there was a touch of tension in the air of the mills that day. It was a touch too slight to define. But the mills to him were like the face of a loved wife, where he could catch shades of feeling almost ahead of expression. He noticed small clusters of the new workers, just three or four of them huddling together in conversation, once or twice too often. He noticed their manner, a manner suggesting a pool room corner, not a factory. He noticed a few glances thrown at him as he went by, glances a shade too pointed and lingering. He dismissed it. It was not quite enough to wonder about, and he had no time to wonder. When he drove up to his former home that afternoon, he stopped his car abruptly at the foot of the hill. He had not seen the house since that May 15th, 6 months ago, when he had walked out of it.
and the sight brought back to him the sum of all he had felt in 10 years of daily homecoming. The strain, the bewilderment, the gray weight of unconfessed unhappiness, the stern endurance that forbade him to confess it, the desperate innocence of the effort to understand his family, the effort to be just. He walked slowly up the path toward the door. He felt no emotion, only the sense of a great solemn clarity. He knew that this house was a monument of guilt, of his guilt toward himself. He had expected to see his mother and Philip. He had not expected the third person who rose, as they did, at his entrance into the living room. It was Lillian. He stopped on the threshold. They stood looking at his face and at the open door behind him. Their faces had a look of fear and cunning, the look of that blackmail through virtue which he had learned to understand, as if they hoped to get away with it by means of nothing but his pity, to hold him trapped when a single step back could take him out of their reach. They had counted on his pity and dreaded his anger. They had not dared consider the third alternative, his indifference. "What is she doing here?" he asked, turning to his mother, his voice dispassionately flat. "Lillian's been living here ever since your divorce," she answered defensively. "I couldn't let her starve on the city pavements, could I?" The look in his mother's eyes was half plea, as if she were begging him not to slap her face, half triumph, as if she had slapped his. He knew her motive. It was not compassion. There had never been much love between Lillian and her. It was their common revenge against him. It was the secret satisfaction of spending his money on the ex-wife he had refused to support. Lillian's head was poised to bow in greeting, with the tentative hint of a smile on her lips, half timid, half brash. He did not pretend to ignore her. He looked at her, as if he were seeing her fully, yet as if no presence were being registered in his mind. He said nothing, closed the door, and stepped into the room. His mother gave a small sigh of uneasy relief and dropped hastily into the nearest chair, watching him, nervously uncertain of whether he would follow her example. "What was it you wanted?" he asked, sitting down. His mother sat erect and oddly hunched, her shoulders raised, her head half lowered. "Mercy, Henry," she whispered. "What do you mean? Don't you understand me?" "No." "Well..." She spread her hands in an untidily fluttering gesture of helplessness. "Well..." Her eyes darted about, struggling to escape his attentive glance. "Well, there are so many things to say, and I don't know how to say them, but... Well, there's one practical matter, but it's not important by itself. It's not why I called you here."
"What is it?"
"The practical matter? Our allowance checks, Philip's and mine. It's the first of the month, but on account of that attachment order, the checks couldn't come through. You know that, don't you?"
"I know it."
"Well, what are we going to do?"
"I don't know."
"I mean, what are you going to do about it?"
"Nothing."
His mother sat staring at him, as if counting the seconds of silence. "Nothing, Henry?"
"I have no power to do anything."
They were watching his face with a kind of searching intensity. He felt certain that his mother had told him the truth, that immediate financial worry was not their purpose, that it was only the symbol of a much wider issue. "But, Henry, we're caught short."
"So was I."
"But can't you send us some cash or something?"
"They gave me no warning. No time to get any cash."
"Then..." "Look, Henry, the thing was so unexpected it scared people, I guess. The grocery store refuses to give us credit unless you ask for it. I think they want you to sign a credit card or something. So will you speak to them and arrange it?"
"I will not."
"You won't?"
She choked on a small gasp.
"Why?"
"I will not assume obligations that I can't fulfill."
"What do you mean?"
"I will not assume debts I have no way of repaying."
"What do you mean, no way? That attachment is only some sort of technicality. It's only temporary. Everybody knows that."
"Do they? I don't."
"But, Henry, a grocery bill. You're not sure you'll be able to pay a grocery bill? You? With all the millions you own?"
"I'm not going to defraud the grocer by pretending that I own those millions."
"What are you talking about? Who owns them?"
"Nobody."
"What do you mean?"
"Mother, I think you understand me fully. I think you understood it before I did.
There isn't any ownership left in existence or any property. It's what you've approved of and believed in for years. You wanted me tied. I'm tied. Now it's too late to play any games about it.
Are you going to let some political ideas of yours?
She saw the look on his face and stopped abruptly.